Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read. As I read it, there's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed. Now, there's lots of books that I have now reviewed more than once, and mostly I review them more than once because Juliana is also reading them as well. So Juliana, my girlfriend, is here. Say hi, Juliana.
Hello.
And this has been quite a big project because today is going to be an in-depth discussion of the book by Stanislav Lem called Solaris, which was first written in, and let me quickly jump across here to the Wikipedia page. I might as well go there as well. So yeah, the first edition was in 1961, first published in English in 1970. So yeah, what do you have to say about Solaris? What are we going to do this time out?
Loads of things.
Oh yeah, of course, actually. Cause, let me put it this way. We've been building up to this for a while because Solaris has been quite a big part of our life over the last month or so. I've already done like my normal review, my normal style of review of this book. If you go back to a previous SFBRP episode, which I should have probably looked up before I did this, but let me quickly just open up this page here and I can search for Lem. Where is it? Here, yes. Episode number 132. So it wasn't even that long ago that I read it or listened to it as an audiobook. And the reason I listened to it as an audiobook is because, you know, everyone talks about Stanislav Lem as a great author, you know, and I've read, I think, some of his other short fiction before. I can't remember actually which books I've read or not. But I'd never read Solaris before. And then Audible came out with what was called the Definitive Edition. The idea being that back in the day, Solaris was translated from its original Polish into French, and then the English translation, instead of translating it directly from French, from Polish into English, the translator took the French version and then translated that into English, which means all of the mistakes and all of the bad translations which went through France, and then you get a whole nother layer of that going in. And even Stanislav Lem himself, who could speak and read English perfectly well, because, you know, he enjoyed reading English science fiction. Actually, I don't think he did enjoy reading English science fiction, but anyway, he did read some English science fiction and was great in English. Even he was really upset at how, really pissed off at how bad the English translation was. And so people ask me, like, what Audible did, they couldn't get the rights, or nobody else managed to get the rights to do another English translation because this one publisher, whoever held the rights for the English translation, they stuck by their bad English translation and would never release the translation rights for another book. But Audible, they do audiobooks, and it turns out they're different rights. Maybe one day you'll be able to get ebook rights, and maybe we'll get a new translation or do that. Audible and the, is it Audible Frontiers? It doesn't say Audible Frontiers, it's just Audible. And they got Bill Johnston to do the translation again. I don't really know who he is, but he's a good translator, I guess, and he did a whole new translation directly from Polish into English, and I listened to that and really enjoyed it. It's a really, really good book, so if you're going to choose an audiobook to listen to, well, you might as well choose this, because this translation, you can't read it in print. You can't read it as an ebook. This only exists in Audible, in audio translation. So let's talk a bit, because people at the time said, well, have you read the paper book? Have you read, like, the normal, like, the previous translation, the 1970 English translation? And I said, no. But because we decided to do this one again, yes, now I have. And also Juliana here, she read the Polish to German translation.
Yes.
So let's start off with some of these translations. What should we talk about with translations? It's a bit tricky, isn't it?
It's a bit tricky. First of all, it's amazing how the English translation has totally different names for the characters, which
yes,
I find disturbing.
Yes. So, but I understand it in a way, because there is one character called Snout, and Snout in English means like a pig nose is a snout. So as soon as you call someone Snout, there's names that come along with Snout, which like there's meanings that come along with Snout which may not be intended. But then you think that, well, why change it to Snow? because snow has other connotations, like snow can be like serene and falling and calm, and snout is like pig-like and like he has a snout, you know, it's like, oh, his name is Snout. And there's quite a lot of names which I think mean stuff in this book. Anyway, you can't just nod your head, Juliana. People can't...
Yes, okay. I'll say just yes, then.
Okay, so, but what's the other name that really got to you? I was just bringing that up as an example.
Yeah, one of the main characters. Like, in the original, she's called Harry.
Yeah.
Harry.
Yeah.
And
that's Chris Kelvin's wife.
That's Chris Kelvin's wife.
Yeah.
And in the English translation, she's called Rhea.
Yeah.
Why do you go for Rhea? That's
Well, because it's like Harry backwards. Like Harry, Rhea, yeah. Rhea. So they're yeah. going for the same okay. sound. But in English, Harry even though it's spelled yeah. differently from Harry, it's like, all right, Harry, all right. You know, that bit. So it is yeah. very much, there is very much like it's very much a man's name, a male
true.
Name.
That
so I understand why they change it, but again, in the Audible translation, that wasn't changed. They stuck with
Snout, the original
yeah. Snout and Harry rather than Snow and Rhea.
In the German direct translation from Polish, they stuck with the original names.
Yeah.
And when we compared the translation when we did some sentence searching,
yeah.
We found out that the Audible edition and the German Polish direct translation,
yeah, the direct to English and direct to German translations,
they do quite a good job. They yes. they're really like similar.
Yeah. Well, anyway, let me actually bring up some notes here because I did actually make quite a few notes. There's this one line on page 81, and I'm just going to read it to you from the this is the English to French, and then from French to the French to English translation. It says, "We take off into the cosmos, ready for anything, for solitude, for hardship, for exhaustion, death." Which, first of all, that's a bit of a weird thing because it goes for solitude, for hardship, for exhaustion, death. And it's like, not for death at the end. Have you got that line here
yeah.
as well? But
yeah.
the thing is that that's a bad translation because, of course, you've obviously, like, it's either when it was being translated in French, it was a bad translation. Because in the audiobook, it's not for, you know, for solitude, for hardship, for exhaustion and death. It's not death. It's for self-sacrifice. And what's it in German? It says...
It's death.
Yeah. No, this word here, the martyrdom.
Yeah.
So martyrdom is different from death, isn't it? I mean, that's the whole point, is that if there's going to be martyrdom, it's like you are, like, giving your life
for something
greater.
Bigger, yeah.
Self-sacrifice is giving your life for something greater. And that kind of... And it's just like it's one word different. And you're like, oh, well, what's just one word? And it turns out it's not just one word. It's like every other sentence they've got wrong somewhere. They've missed something out. Because actually, once I'd got about halfway through this book, because I was reading the 1971... from via French translation. Does it actually say who the translator is? I can't see it on the front of the book here. But so what I actually did then is I started listening along to the audiobook because, you know, I listened to it on Audible before, so I could still easily just download it again. It's no problem at all. So I downloaded it and I was reading along with the book while listening to the audio translation. And it really does go to show why Stanislaw Lem was actually really pissed off at how bad the English translation was, because it's just terrible. I mean, it really is bad. It doesn't just, like, change some of the meanings, just the whole thing kind of loses so much of its flavor. So I'm just going to go through some of the lines So, for example, in one of them, it says, "We don't want to conquer the cosmos." This is a line which comes up in all the movies and stuff. We'll get onto the movies because we watch the movies and listen to the audio drama, BBC audio drama as well. Because we don't want to conquer the cosmos. We simply want to extend the boundaries of Earth to the frontiers of the cosmos. And then the other one is like, "We're not trying to conquer the cosmos. We're just trying to expand Earth to its limits." You know, so sure, it's like half a sentence shorter, but then you get like, you know, that's all right, you know, you can take it, either translation would, but then you get onto something like this: "The room was glowing in red twilight. Someone," that one sentence, "someone was sitting in the chair," and that was the other sentence. And then in the audio it would say something like, "In the red light of dawn I saw this person sitting in the chair," and it's like, which one is more poetic, which one is more, you know, literate. You know, I'm not even trying to say which one sounds better. I've got in every single thing. Like, the book would say, I'm not a prisoner here. And the audiobook would say, I'm not shackled to this place. And, like, I'm not a prisoner here, I'm not shackled to this place. They're two different... I mean, even though they kind of say the same thing, one of them says it in a way which has, like, a real, different sound. This is another one. Here on, was this page 70 or something? I choked back a feeling of blind rage and pity. Is the book, and the audiobook is, my heart was overcome by blind fury mixed with pity. The whole idea of blind fury mixed with pity, it's like blind rage and pity. Blind fury mixed with pity. It's a different... Anyway, my eyes blinked open, eyes squinted, and I'm like, okay, so which one is it? Do your eyes blink open, because blinking open is like the action of opening your eyes more, or do your eyes squint, which is the action of like closing them more? It's like, which way round is this? Do you
remember? This was one of the things I had a note about as well in the German translation.
Yeah.
Because obviously, in the German translation, they mixed... both. I blinked the eyes open.
Yeah, it says blinked eyes open.
Yeah.
And eyes squinted.
Yeah, yeah. And exactly. And the from like how they created that sentence in German is a mix of
both. Say it in German.
But then ich kniff die Augen ein.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist.
In German.
No. Ich kniff die Augen zu, which is like squinted.
Yeah.
And so it's obviously like a mix of both.
Well, what they probably have here is you probably have like a Polish saying, like a way of Polish saying something with the eyes, which doesn't translate into like blinking. It's like blinking your eyes open. It's like, no, when you blink your eyes closed for a minute and then open again. Yeah. So blinking eyes open or squinting, each translator has kind of taken a different stab at it. And in the German translation is just...
It's gone a bit wrong.
Yeah, it maybe gone a little bit wrong. What's the other one here? There's a few more of these. Oh, yeah. Blind, it goes... One of them says, oh, and there's just blind alleys. This is talking about the science of Solaris, this planet. Blind alleys is one idea. And then every exit led to a dead end. Every exit led to a dead end and blind alleys. Because a blind alley... is an alley with a bend in it, so you can't see if it's a dead end or not.
Oh,
do you understand that?
Yes.
So it's like a blind alley could, like down a blind alley could be what you're looking for, but
could,
down a dead end is not. You know, you're never going to find where. And also there was so much time in the book translation, the 1970 English translation. There was so many times when it would just say what was going to happen. It's like the narrator is saying what somebody is going to say, if you know what I mean. It's sort of like,
yes,
they said this, but instead of like letting the sentence stand at its own weight, and then if it needs any clarification, clarify what it meant, it would just say, and he said this, meaning this, and then would say it. For example, there's one, it goes... blah, 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 blah. Oh, no. So he goes, I counted clumsily, blah, 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 blah. In other words, it's sort of like saying already, it's even before you hear what he said clumsily, the translator has said, this sentence you're going to read is going to be a clumsy sentence.
Yeah.
And then you read that sentence, you're like, well, you're just kind of setting up there like in a really bad way. And then in the direct English translation, which you get from the audible, it's like, You read the sentence, blah, 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 and then it said, it sounded clumsy even to me. And that's the best way to do it, because when you read that sentence, you go, are you sure? And then it goes, it sounded clumsy easy to me. It's like, yes, you're not sure.
The reader has an impression of that sentence.
Yes.
And then it clarifies that also the character itself
has the same opinion out of it. And so many times... It's just one of those times where you just go, ah, right, what we have here is someone translating the book who is getting across the story and is getting across what is happening in the scenes, but doing it in like a super clumsy, in a way that sounds clumsy even to me, to quote the book.
Yes.
And you get to the end of the book and you go, that is really clumsy. And so if you want my opinion, if you're English and you want to read, and this is a weird thing to say, but if you want to read Solaris by Lem, I really do recommend reading the audible version, because it is far, far superior in every way. And we've not even talked about the book yet. We just wanted to get this kind of, these kind of translation things out of the way.
Yes.
First of all, have you got more stuff about translation? Because you've got lots of notes there as well. Or is it just some things about the German translation, which probably doesn't have a huge amount to...
One here where it says he turned the whatever, the transmitter off.
Yeah.
And then it obviously means that he was drinking the rest of some brew.
Yeah.
And then he went to sleep.
Yeah.
But by just like in German, if you have a word which says drink.
Yeah.
And by just putting two little dots on top of the A, which is like in German, the word is trank, which is the past of drink.
Yeah.
And if you put A, like some two dots on top.
Yeah, the umlaut.
It's tränk, which is more if you give water to pigs, it means you whatever you do in English.
Yeah, you feed them.
You feed them.
Yeah.
And that at some point, suddenly that totally changes.
It changes the kind of thing. Yeah.
The meaning.
It's like from food and fodder. You know, in English, you can get food and fodder. Two very different things.
Exactly.
There, yeah.
So, and I was wondering, when I went through that book, and I've seen many of these little mistakes, like.
But you're thinking, is that in the Polish version? Like, was that originally there?
Yeah, I don't know. And if you think, like, anybody who would read through before it got published, you would think everybody who is German would see these mistakes, and then
there is a big mistake here again in the 1970 translation. Just missed out a line. This didn't happen too often, but this was one time they go. It's like, listen, Kelvin. He smiled ruefully. Blah blah blah. Do you want to leave the station? Yes, with her. The silence while he considered his reply also revealed something else. He's like, wait a second. Why is he considering his reply when he just replied? And it turns out that the audio version just has another line in there. It's a one word line, which is yes. And in the German translation, it's there. And in the Audible audiobook translation, it's there. But in this, they just miss out the line. So yeah, if you actually want to get even the full book, do this thing. So we're not going to do spoilers yet, because actually we didn't just read the book and listen to the audiobook and read the German translation. We did some other things as well. What we decided to do is be Solaris completists. So we checked out two movies and an audio drama. You didn't listen to the audio drama,
no,
did you?
No, I did not.
But you should do, because it's really good. So I'll just talk a little bit about the audio drama. The BBC did an audio drama. And again, it's one of those weird things that you can kind of see when... not when it was in, but what the source material was. It was definitely written from using the book translation, like the 1970 English translation, as the source material for this. For example, the names was Snow and
Rhea
rather than Snout and Harry. And I think there's a few other little names changed here and there. But so that was noticeable. And also quite a few of the lines that are in the book. There's there's a line which pops up in, of course, all of the book versions, and in the movie version, the 1971 Solaris, Russian, which we'll talk about in the middle. And the whole idea is that, it goes, man has gone out to explore other worlds without having first explored his own labyrinth of dark passages and secret chambers, you know. The idea being that we're going out, and the great, great line from the audio drama, the BBC audio drama, which I can't remember from the books or the movies, and it says, yeah, we're going to Solaris. We won't learn anything about it, but we might learn a lot about ourselves. And that really wraps up, you know, even though they're condensing, you know, it's like an 8-hour audio book, and they make it down into a 2-hour audio drama. So they've got to condense it down, and there's some really good writing. A lot of the lines are direct. A lot of the lines are directly from the book, but there's quite a lot of new lines as well. And I really liked it. Oh, we probably won't learn anything out about it, but we'll learn a lot about ourselves. So what I just want to say is that in comparison, we'll get onto the movies in a second, but this audiobook drama, I do think, is the best of the three adaptations that I've done. There's two movies and this audio drama. Of those three, the audio drama is the one that brings out Solaris the best. It's still 2 hours, like the movie. You know, it's like the length of the 1971 movie. But it brings out the, like, kind of like the horror about it, because it's all with sounds. And a lot of the stuff in the book, the characters don't see. There's, you know, Chris Kelvin, he goes to a space station around another planet. I mean, we're kind of presuming that you know the Solaris already. Go listen to the other podcast, or if you read the book or seen the movie, you know this kind of thing. He goes to a spaceship which is hovering above a planet or in orbit around a planet, depending on which adaptation you're going for. And but he doesn't see very much, but he hears things. He hears pattering of feet. He hears laughter. He hears screaming from behind doors. When they go into, when they have conferences between the different scientists on board, they put, you know, they don't meet in person. They talk over the radio, and you can hear things happening in the background. That comes across really well in an audio drama. It's literally, as they're going, holy shit, holy shit. And there's this like soundscape, because that's what these audio, like, these BBC audio dramas do. They get, you know, really good actors in, some really good sound effects. Let me bring it up here. You can get this on Audible as well. You can spend an Audible credit on where's that? I had another window with stuff in. Let's skip across here. Yes, you can check out, what is it there? The classic radio sci-fi Solaris, narrated by Ron Cook, Joanne Froggatt, and I'm sure that, I mean, there's lots of other people doing it as well. But yeah, it is a good, and I think if you're in the UK, you can listen to it on the BBC iPlayer. If you're outside of the UK, you can get it direct from Audible, or apparently it's possible to get it as elsewhere without paying. And it's on Amazon. If you just want to get the CDs, you can do it as well. But it is really great. I'm just trying to see when it was released. Yeah, from 2008. I mean, that's when it was on Audible. So,
is this like the BBC?
Is the BBC audio.
Is it the same way they had an audio drama with War of the Worlds? Was that also BBC?
War of the Worlds has been done with the BBC before, but the famous one is back in 1930. That was an American radio station. I really don't know.
And this is something in the UK that's quite famous. These BBC,
BBC Radio 4 has audio dramas all the time. Like every day, there'll be some kind of audio drama, book adaptation or narration or something like that. So it's just a spoken word. Radio 4 is a spoken word. Radio station, you know, lots of news, lots of current events. They have like a long running audio drama, like a soap opera called The Archers, and that's been running for like 60 years or 50 years or something now, like that. Yeah, it's like the longest running serial entertainment ever is The Archers, and that's always at like at 7 o'clock or 7:05. My mother used to listen quite a lot.
So the whole family sits around the radio.
Well, it used to be, I guess it used to be, but it's not so much anymore. But I grew up without a television in the house, so Radio 4 entertainment and audio drama was a really big kind of source of my, you know, like not popular culture, but you know, some stuff like this. I remember there was a really, really fantastic, like award-winning audio drama about a bombing raid on Germany. Kind of, it was like a fictionalized one, but it followed in real time what it would have been like. It's like, okay, like, so it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The bombers, the Lancaster bombers, are taking off, and then it's like you know, it's 7 o'clock and they're crossing into Germany, and you hear a scene of them crossing, and then now it's 10 o'clock or something and they're coming in and they go all the way and they kind of reach Dresden. It's not Dresden, but you know, it's that similar kind of thing, and you go, and then it continued throughout the night all the way through until like 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm misremembering it, but like we were staying up and listening to there was other programming in between, but as you were listening, you're like, oh, I'm not going to bed. I want to know who gets back, and there's some good, and I can't remember which podcast, I think I mentioned it before, I listened to Stephen King's Salem's Lot as an audio drama. It was a BBC audio drama, and I think I talked about that in the SFF audio podcast once when we were talking about it, and I listened to it again recently, and at the time I remember this just, and it was just a weird thing, this little line about this guy kind of getting a girl, you know, and saying, oh, I can't remember what the line was, and I was like, oh, so that's how dating works, that's what you do. And then when I listened to it again, I realized how this one line from this Salem's Lot audio drama
it influenced
my life, and it worked. You know, the way that he approached this dating and kissing a girl. Now I can't even remember what it was, but when I listened to it again, I was like, holy shit! I didn't realize how influenced I was by this one thing. So,
so these BBC audio dramas can be influential for your life.
Yes, they can be. Anyway, so this Solaris one is really good. It's really creepy, and it follows. It doesn't follow the story exactly because, again, it's condensing it down. But it hits the major points. It hits the major plot points, which I don't want to go into now because that's kind of spoiler territory. I just want to put this out there. It's a 2-hour audio drama. It's totally worth listening to. It's just really good. And like I say, if you're not going to listen to the audiobook or read a direct from Polish into your natural, not natural language, but into your, you know, mother tongue, like you did the direct to German one. Or if you speak Polish, that's probably the best way to do it.
Yeah, read the Polish book.
Yeah, learn Polish.
And then tell us if we get something totally wrong.
Yeah, any
here.
Polish people there, tell us what some of these, like, what is the eyes blinking open, eyes squinted, what was the one in German, opening your eyes shut or something like that, whatever it had been, opening your eyes out or whatever it is. Yeah. Anyway, so let's go on to the movies. So the next thing that we did after reading the book and after listening to the audiobook, and I think I actually listened to the audio drama halfway through because we watched the 1971 Solaris, the Andrei Tarkovsky Solaris. We watched it in two parts, didn't we? We like watched it because it's quite a long movie, and we watched like an hour one night, and the other 2 hours the next night.
Yeah,
it's not that long. but let me see, is there a running time? Yeah, 165 minutes. So that's like almost 3 hours. No, a bit off 3 hours there. So yeah, quite a bit of the movie. I think I actually listened to the audio drama like in between. You know, like between the day. Oh, was it the next day?
It was quite spread out.
Yeah, we watched over.
You read Solaris, and then I read Solaris, and then you listened to the audio book.
No, I was listening. I remember I finished reading the 1970 English translation while listening to the audiobook, and then that evening we started Solaris the movie.
But in between, we also did the Triffids.
We read the Triffids. Yeah, because you were like, after Solaris, you were like, oh, Solaris.
I want something with action.
Yeah, and then you read the Triffids, and you're like, wee, this is more like it.
Yeah.
So,
can I say that looking back now, like after the Solaris movie marathon, I actually, now looking backwards, I quite enjoyed the book as it is.
Like you appreciate the book a lot more, is what you're saying?
A lot, because it has this long scenes where, like, it has long periods of something.
Yeah,
it doesn't. The movies really, like, especially the second movie with
we'll get onto that last.
Yeah, it doesn't really transfer that to the audience. You only when you actually read that book, you have these
explorations into science
in your mind. Yeah. That's
another good thing about the audio drama is that, like, the movie, the 1971 Russian movie, a lot of it looks fantastic. I really like the look of a lot of it, which I'll get into in a second. But Solaris is a planet which has got these big sculpture-y things, and it's constantly changing, and it's flowing, and it's never this. You know, it's only got a few little continents, but the sea is this sentient sea, the whole ocean that is planet, and that's really difficult to put on film. Mm. And like in the Tarkovsky version, they kind of just show like slowed down sand shifting around in a box, and so the mystery and the wonder and the scale of Solaris is kind of diminished quite a bit via its representation on.
Yeah, in my head it always looked
screen.
I don't know why, but in my head it looked like a pink and blue kind of plastic sculpture thing.
For me, it always looked like stop motion plasticine models, but on a scale and resolution, or, you know, like on a grand scale, you know, like on a continent wide scale, plasticine stop motion animation. That's always
changing all the
time. Just continually changing. And if I was to do that in a movie, I would. You know, it's weird to say, oh, I'd just get some animators to play with plasticine, because it would, you know, it just wouldn't work that way. But that would always be the touchstone. It's like, okay, imagine, like, you know, stop motion because then everything has to be connected. Yeah. You know, everything has to, like, as soon as one bit is disconnected, it just falls down. You know,
of course.
Even though in the book, it pretty much explains that time, like different dimensions, like they'll go in somewhere and it's like non-Euclidean. So they'll go in and they'll turn left and then they come out and it looks like, well, I don't know, it's not that they come out, but like, you know, like dimensions are twisted and time dimensions are twisted within this.
And also all these things about Solaris, that's very well explained in the books because when you as the reader reads through Calvin's eyes as he reads books.
Yeah.
So everything is explained to you. The whole scientific research about Solaris, everything gets like into your brain about these.
But it is, and this is the thing that I really wanted to bring up about the 1971 movie, the Russian one. And again, this was translated, of course, from Polish into Russian, into a Russian book, and then he used the Russian book to do that. Mm. And then we watched it with subtitles, so then it's been translated.
Oh, yeah, we watched it. The Russian movie with English subtitles.
Yeah, so we did, that was Polish to Russia, Russia to English. So there's another levels of translation. But again, you recognise quite a lot of the lines from the book, and they were like, and when they were phrased slightly different, they'll say, oh, when it's translated via French, it comes this way. When it's translated via German, it comes this way. When it's translated via Russian, it comes this way. And we can see these different routes of translation, which I think is just pretty impressive. But in the book, Chris Kelvin will go into a library and pick up a book and then start reading. And we get this, and then even in some of these books that he's reading, when he's recounting the history of the science of Solaris, it talks about other people reading books. Yes. So we're reading a book in which Chris is reading a book in which another scientist is reading another book and commenting on it or doing like a meta study of the studies of Solaris so far.
Yeah.
What I really liked about which was a bit weird, Tarkovsky is done, he really plays around with the language of cinema in a way which either you have to be a bit of a, what did you call it, a cineast?
Cineast,
You need to be like appreciating the filmmaking to appreciate you need to appreciate the rules of filmmaking. So when he breaks these rules, so at the beginning, there's Chris Kelvin and it starts off on Earth. So he's on Earth, he hasn't gone to Solaris yet. The book starts when he's like approaching Solaris. But here, he's on Earth and he's like, okay, you're going to go to Solaris because you've got to go and sort out a problem, or you're going to go there and do your studies there. And this guy, again, we don't need to go into the story, but this guy says, here, watch this film. So then they put on this film on a big TV screen of like a scientific, not like an inquiry by the scientists about this thing.
Conference.
Yeah, it's like a conference thing. And in there they go, well, at the time you said this. And then they put on a film. So we're watching Chris Kelvin watching a conference where they are watching a testimony of this guy when he was younger, like 30 years before, telling of what happened when he was a pilot flying across Solaris. And I was watching this just going, what? Like, you know, and I understood it, but I remember that when we were just testing out the file, because we downloaded this because I couldn't find it and didn't want to order the DVD, to be honest. So we were watching it, and I clicked forward in the movie a bit, and I was like, whoa, what's happening here? Because that was in black and white. You know,
some of it was in black and white.
And I didn't realize, like, when I was just, like, because I just clicked on a few points at the same place just to make sure that the subtitles were working, and it came up, and I was like, wow. And then I clicked, like, a second later, and it was in color, and people were in a cottage in the country, and then I clicked again, and it's just this one guy looking at the screen, and I was like, wait a second, that's all in
does
the same...
Does that belong together?
Yeah, does that belong together? Yes, and they actually all did belong together.
And he plays with that, and then in the end it was quite funny when you said, oh yeah, this is black and white now, and now it's going to be color again.
Yes,
because you got into his scheme
once you understand, and this is the great thing, like once I understood the language that Tarkovsky was using, I could it's not like then I could predict what he was going to do, but you could see, because I knew the book, because I'd read the book, like, you know, I'd finished the book that day or, you know, the other day. So I knew what the next scene was going to be, and I could predict, oh, it's going to go into color now when Harry turns up again or whatever it is. Like when he opens his eyes and sees Harry, that's going to be great. Another thing that happens is that he brings out the weirdness of the situation. Now, normally, if you had a camera that's pointing at someone and then you pan the camera across or swing the camera around and point it at someone else, when you swing the camera back again, the first person should be in the same place that they left them, just to make it less confusing. And then when you swing it back, the other person should be there. So if you swing a camera backwards and forwards between two people, or like from one side of the room to the other, and then go back again, you would expect the person to be there. But in this one scene, this quite long camera shot, there's like four camera moves where it goes from one person to the other person, and then
it continues,
and then
going,
it continues
around,
going in that direction. And the first person is in a different position. You obviously like ran around behind the camera again and then stood in a different place. And then the camera swings back and the second guy isn't where he was, but then it keeps going a bit longer and he's over sitting in another chair. And you're watching it going, wait a second, what's going on in this scene? And it's a real thing.
It makes loads of confusion, but...
It's very much like Kubrick, you know, like Stanley Kubrick. It's like that same kind of thing. It's like, wait a second, that... If he walked through that door, he should be here now, and then he's like, you know, miles away.
At the same time, this is the only possibility for a filmmaker to create confusion, that which comes when you read a book.
Yeah.
And you find out,
what's going on here?
That guy is really confused. This is the guy is confused himself.
Yes.
And this is the way he can use that to make the audience be confused and think, oh, well, this is a totally confusing situation. Yeah. What's going on there?
The other thing I really liked about the look of this movie is the space station. Kelvin, he's like this haunted figure. Chris Kelvin, he's haunted, but he goes into a place which is obviously haunted. Like, not just in a haunted as a haunted, even though you get that kind of thing as well. But this space station is meant to be like 80 years old, and when it was first set up, the science of Solaris was, you know, it was going along, and there was hundreds of people there, and they were all getting well, and then it didn't, and then this still couldn't understand Solaris, and then Solaris is still a massive mystery, and then people are going, you know what, fuck Solaris, and we've done all the observations we need, now Solaris is becoming much more
like a side thing.
Well, it's not so much a side thing, but it turns a lot more into like a theory and academic rather than exploring. Yes. It says it's quite clear there's no great explorers anymore, and Solaris is just this outpost, and in the end, like, there's four scientists there, and then three scientists there, and whatever. So he turns up, and there's just shit laying around the place.
It's so messy.
The corridors are all twisted over, and there's holes in the wall, and, you know, the lighting doesn't work. And then they go into this library, and the library looks like it's 80 years old. Because you're going, what's going on there? It's like, but the library is the one place that they've tried to keep slightly nice. But then it's just messy, and there's weird artwork hanging on the wall. And you're like this artwork is older than the characters in the movie. And they're looking at it and going, what? That's a bit dated. You know, it's the whole, just the look of the movie. Anything inside the space station, except then he'll go and look out the window and see Solaris. And then the special effects catch up with you and you go, oof. Like, so it's one of those movies that if they did a digitally remastered version. But it could be good if you could manage to do special effects which don't look like modern, it's not like your Star Wars special edition where they do that, but you know, like the Star Wars you know, like the digitally remastered one where they made it so you couldn't see, you know, the blacks were actually black and you couldn't see spaceships through black stuff, you know, they took out some of those lines, so they cleaned up the special effects rather than replace the special effects.
Yes.
I think that could be done, you know, it's that balance that you could strike with a Solaris special edition. The thing that I didn't quite like so much about the Solaris 1971 movie is that there's this, like, quite a few long sections where you're just like, okay, after this thing, why do we have... I mean, I don't know how long it is, but it felt like 5 minutes worth of footage of him driving through a science fiction city. And of course, when you drive through a science fiction city in 1971 in Russia, you actually... I think you just go to Tokyo. Was it just Tokyo?
Yeah,
it looked like some Japanese city.
Yeah.
Or so. I wasn't quite sure. But they just show in colour, or was it in black and white?
That was the
colour part going through. And you're just like, so why are we... Why is he just driving all the way through this city in the rain? Not quite sure what was going on.
No.
You didn't really need that. And there was another bit later on where he's like, and now we're going to have shots of this painting for a while. Now, this painting might be famous in Russia, and we just missed the connections. And I understood what they were doing, but it's like, you didn't...
It's like, they took, like, you have this picture, but instead of showing the whole picture, they just showed elements of it.
Yeah.
And then went through this landscape, and then it was a snowy landscape.
And then you turn out it was more than one picture anyway.
But you watch that movie, mm-hmm. and then you think, why do I have to watch that now? What what is the message behind that?
Yeah.
And I did not get it at all. It was just like, oh, can it end now? I'm falling asleep.
Yeah, it was quite near the end and it was late at that point, wasn't it? Yeah.
And then you think, well, and this is the cineastic part of it. Like, if you're like really into this, it's about filmmaking.
And
you will probably enjoy this, maybe.
Even so, I do think like you've got to put aside like 3 days to, or 2 days to watch it or something like that. If you want to go through all the way through, but there are these sections which are quite long. However, the feeling of the movie is the same feeling as you get from the book.
From the book, yeah, it transfers it really well.
Really well, which means that when you listen to, I mean, like I'm saying, I'm just going by the audiobook version because then that's a good time. You know, if it's going to be like 8 hours for someone to read it to you, to compress it down into 2.5 hours worth of movie, they're going to have to cut corners. But actually, there's not a lot of corners cut, like, story-wise.
It's true.
A lot of the stuff that's taken out is like, and now here's another lecture about Solaris. You know, they kind of cut down on that quite a bit. They have the Gibberian scientists do a recording of, like, here's what we know about Solaris, you know, and talk to him about that way.
But, so they compressed that down to that kind of lecture.
But overall, there wasn't any plot holes. The only plot hole, I think, is that last shot. I think that last shot was a bit too... They were going to suddenly go, and now... This is no longer a Lem story. This is now a Philip K. Dick story, and it's all happening in his head. Or, you know, it's one of those kind of things, and you're like, that twist isn't. That's not a great twist. And also,
he does never leave the station.
Yeah. At the end of the book, he goes off and leaves. Actually, at the end of the audio drama, he leaves the station as well. I've been here all this time and I've never actually set foot on Solaris. Yeah. And so, in the audiobook version, I think he does that as well at the end. So that felt good. I was like, yes, this is a good adaptation. But we were both disappointed that he didn't leave. But again, with the special effects of the day, really limited.
I think we would have been even more disappointed if we would have seen him outside there. Yeah. And also, the start of the movie, you really have to just go for it. And
get through that bit.
Get through it.
Thing is, I really enjoyed the start of the movie. You were like, oh, this is too long. I like him just walking around and looking at streams and stuff and this little cottage out in the country.
And then there's his family. There's
I really liked his father and his mother.
And then you think, why is he burning something? What's going on there? And it's just I wanted it to be like about Solaris, and then
it started on Earth.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, we'll talk more about that in contrast the two movies, because what we'll move on to now is the other movie adaptation. So let's bring up, here we go, Solaris from 2002, and we have. This is by Steven Soderbergh directing. Actually, we didn't even say who the actors were. Of course, these are all Russian actors here. So we've got Natalia Bondarchuk as Harry, and it's Harry in this one as well, of course. Yeah. And Donatess. But anyway, so there's the few main characters: Harry, Chris Calvin, Snout, Sartorius, and Gabarian are the main characters on Solaris. So here we have, in those roles, we have George Clooney, we have Natasha McElhoney. Anyway, she is best known as the love interest in Truman Show, because we were looking at her and going, well, who is she? You know, you recognize those eyes and you realize that she's this pouty person. And then Snow, because again, it's Snow, not Snout.
In the George Clooney version, they actually go for the 70s translation.
Quite a bit. But then Sartorius isn't Sartorius. Sartorius becomes Gordon, who is then played by Viola Davis, who is a female.
Yeah, I think that's quite a big thing.
It is a big change going around there. So suddenly we have a female on board, and then you're like... But, like, one of the main points of Solaris was that it was, like, all guys, and again, we might as well get into slight spoiler territory here, that Solaris looks inside their memories as they sleep and brings out what are called visitors, who then visit them, like, and these are, like, real people, you know. It's introduced pretty quickly, like, soon in the book. Anyway, these visitors turn up, these guests, these apparitions who are actually very physical there turn up. And one of the main points of the book, and that comes out in the Tarkovsky 1971 movie, is that everybody else's visitor is a dark person from their past, and that's the same actually with the main character as well. Yeah. Chris Kelvin's is a character from a dark part of his past.
Yes,
but everyone else's visitors are like, you know, one of them has got kids, yeah, and the other one's got this the weird dwarf kind of person. You're not quite sure what the other one, you know, in the book you're never quite sure what some of these are, but there's going around and George Clooney's in this one. Chris Kelvin, played by George Clooney, his wife turns up and she's beautiful and got these big pouty eyes, but she's female. And the whole point is that the other main characters, their visitors aren't female, except Gibarians or Jabari. You know, what is it they called? In this movie, they
Jabarian.
Jabarian, and yeah, it was for us. It was always. Gil, yeah, Gibarian. Anyway, it's Gibarian or Jibarian, whichever way around it goes. And his visitor was a woman.
Yes. But she didn't play anything.
But she was there. But you know, but the point. But it was this weird thing that hers was a woman, and Jibarian, again, mild spoiler, commits suicide. Actually, we find that out right in the first chapter. Yeah, it's not really a spoiler. Yeah. But he commits suicide. In my opinion, one of the reasons he commits suicide is because his visitor is an adult female. And the thing that, and again, this is spoiler territory, the thing that is actually made clear in this movie and is kind of hinted at in the book and is really well done in the audio drama is that these apparitions are human-like, but they can be killed. It is possible to kill them. Yeah. And the only way to stop them driving you crazy is for you to kill them.
Yeah.
So the really freaky part of this book is that you have to understand that Snout and Sartorius are daily either having to put up with their visitor who comes back at each time they sleep and dream, or they're killing them. And they're really difficult to kill. And that's what Chris Kelvin does when his visitor first turns up. He's like, okay, get in this rocket. Vroom, bye, see you, like that. He does it in a very clean way.
Yeah. Because he doesn't know anything about it, he thinks that that's it.
You think, that's it, my visitor's gone. But no, there's going to be another visitor to turn up the next day. So the darkness of this book is that these apparitions, which are representing the past of whatever. I mean, it's difficult to say. But daily, these scientists are having to kill them. Now, if you're killing, a kid, that's one thing. If you're killing, a dwarf thing, which is which is kind of mentioned in the book, that's another thing. But if you're killing, an adult female, that's a different level, if you know what I mean. And I'm not just saying, which means Sartorius shouldn't be a female character in Gordon, but if you're going to do that, that character has to have more meaning as a female than it does as a man. Yes. Because that the one of the main themes of this book is the darkness within men. It's that kind of male, not caring for children, the male dominance of women, the male. And again, I don't want to be too sexist about this. And they're saying, all characters should be men if they're men originally. You know, there are some characters which work really well as female, which, you know, like M in James Bond, always a man, and then Judi Dench. Does it female, you know? No problem at all in that case. And that can happen time and time again. No problem with that idea. But when you do the book, and when one of the main themes of the book is men on a space station being visited by women and children that they have abused in the past harmed in the past.
It's all about that. And they live through that over and over and over again. And that is the main point in it.
Yeah, so when you switch one of those characters to a female, you're like,
it's
okay.
Everybody can have that problem.
Everybody can have it, but they didn't do enough with it in this movie.
Yeah, they didn't play it with it. It was just a fact, and they just You as the audience is just like, get okay, she's a female.
But I mean, there's no problem. But in this, so anyway, let's just actually move this up because we've been talking 50 minutes already, and we haven't got to the final review of this movie. So, yeah. People said like, I read this thing, you know, saying, oh, and there's two movie versions. There's the Tarkovsky version, which is far superior to the 2002 Soderbergh, yes, George Clooney version. And I was like, well, how can it be superior? I mean, I really like the Tarkovsky version, but it was too long. There was stuff about it that I didn't like.
Yeah, and
but
we watched through it and thought, okay, well, it's not that awesome. But then we watched the Soderbergh movie.
Yeah, this was only like 3 days ago that we watched this. And I was like, well, how bad can this be? And we put it on, and it turns out it can be worse. But it's not going to be worse. It can just be a terrible, terrible movie. And I'm not even talking about, like, is it a good representation of the book Solaris?
Yes.
Which I think the movie and the audio, the 71 movie and the audio drama is a good representation of what's in the book. Of even if, like, if Lem was going to make a movie or an audio drama, he'd be like, yeah, with the compromises that we have of the technology, the media, and the special effects and all that kind of stuff, this would be, I'd be happy with this. Yeah. But you think, this was made in 2002. Like, didn't we learn anything about movie making? Like, if we're going to make a Hollywood version of this, and like I say, we just brought up the here on the IMDb page. Just looking at the poster, Solaris, 1972. You've got Harry standing beside Chris Kelvin, and they're both looking at themselves in the mirror, and you see the side of Kelvin's face, and you see the front of his face in the mirror, and you see the back of Harry's face, like, because she's looking in the mirror, and then you don't even see the front of her face. So just this
it's
poster.
So creepy.
I mean, this is from the Criterion Collection movie, so they know what they're doing. The Criterion Collection, they're bringing out, like, the best aspect of this movie. But you look at that, and you just go, holy shit, there is so much happening in there. And then you flick across to Solaris, and you've probably seen this poster. George Clooney, Solaris, you know, produced by James Cameron, and it's just George Clooney looking very much like George Clooney with his grey hair. They've got the grey hair, they've got the chin and the stubble in there, and his big bushy eyebrows and, you know, dark skin. And then, you know, beautiful female. And it's just two people kissing. And you're like, really? That's what you think this movie is about? Solaris, 1971. Two people looking at themselves in the mirror, and you can't even see one of their faces, and they're just haunted.
You have a distance there, but at the same time, you have something that is very close. And here, in the George Clooney one, it's just...
Very closeness.
There's no distance. There's no disturbance and nothing. It's just a couple kissing. It doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
It could be just like it could be like any other, like the beach or whatever.
Yeah, and it could be any science fiction-y thing. And
it doesn't even need to be science fiction. It could be just a love story.
And then you go, well, why in Solaris, Tarkovsky Solaris, why do they get these big long stretches of not a lot happening and people looking at each other?
Yeah.
And there's this great thing, like, they get the visitor, and then the visitor turns up the next day and she's wearing the same dress. And there's still her old dress just laying there. And then she takes off exactly the same dress, and you're like, that is such... I mean, in the book, it's a big thing.
Yeah.
And in the movie, it's a big plot point, but it takes time to develop that. It takes time. It's like, oh, I'm in this dress. I'm going to take off this dress. And then that visitor leaves. And then the next visitor turns up, and it's like, I'm in the same dress. Now I have to take the same dress off again. It's going to make a 2.5-hour movie last two hours and 45 minutes, you know, to add those extra bits in. But by adding in all of those different things, makes the entire movie... like, have this vibrancy, this, even though it's long, and you think at the time when you're watching it, you go, oh, this is a bit boring. Why are you spending so long getting out of a dress? Then the next time the dress turns up, you're like, holy shit, the dress! And then you're keeping an eye. It's like, is there another dress going to turn up? Because if we see another dress, it means that Chris Kelvin's done something off screen that we've not seen before.
Yeah.
And Solaris, 1972, no plot holes. I mean, there are a few little things where you go, oh, why did that happen? If you've not read the book, but it would be explained within the movie itself. And in Solaris 2002 by Soderbergh with George Clooney and stuff, it's just all the time you're just going, what's going on? And he's tried to go for like this filmmaking stuff, which just doesn't even begin to work.
I just realized that this movie is 99 minutes long.
Yeah, 167 minutes to 99 minutes.
You have to cut out a lot.
And you cut out anything about Solaris. Solaris is just this place where they're like NASA set up a base there, and now they're trying to sell it for like commercial purposes. And but just the acting is terrible. George Clooney does an okay job of looking a bit haunted, yeah. but then yeah. like literally from one scene to the next, he switched from haunted to like la la la, I'm in love, and he's in love with the wrong woman anyway, you know. And there's this whole thing, and then they're just explaining stuff to each other. It's like, don't just explain to, like, everything that took 5 minutes for two characters to look at each other and come to that conclusion in Tarkovsky's version, in Soderbergh's version, it's just like one character will just say, I'm thinking this, like, yeah. I am representing this character. Yeah. How about you? Well, I'm representing this character. And yeah. and those developments in the movie and in the book, you know, so many of these relationships aren't, like, spelled out. Even in the book, you've got to pick them up. And yes. there's a lot of subtlety there. And in this, and in 2002 Solaris, Soderbergh's Solaris, it's just like, ah, but I am Harry. No, sorry, I am Rhea. You know, yeah, they take the English names too. Yeah. Another thing, terrible, terrible acting on the part of the female characters. Like, who's the Viola Davis? She is trying her best to play Gordon, which is a male character which has been transferred across into a female role. First of all, massive spoilers. She just turns up. She's okay meeting up. That one of the main points of her character is that she never leaves the lab.
Yes.
She takes over the lab and doesn't leave. And yeah, getting into much more spoiler territory here. Like, you can't leave your visitor. You can't be in a different room. And if you go into a different room, they get violently, like, self-harming kind of, they're going to break through a door
things.
To be there.
Yes.
And this happens once with George Clooney. And Natasha McElhoney, or whatever her name is, he goes, right, I'm going out. And she's like, no, no, don't leave. And then he's like, okay, I won't leave you. And then, like, three scenes later, he's like, oh, I'm leaving. Is that okay? And she'll be like, yeah, I'll be fine. And I'm just like, this is one of the main points about Solaris, yeah. is that you can't leave your apparition. They are attached to your brain. They're attached to your psyche. They're attached to your memory. And as soon as you leave, you are their soul. You are two people sharing a soul. And if you leave the room, their soul has left the room, or whatever you want to talk about, yes. it, science fictionally, spiritually, whatever.
Yes.
And here they're just like, oh, I'm just going.
We just go to the conference, and we have we have these three main characters, like the three.
Snow Gordon and Chris Kelvin, yeah.
We have these three people, and then the only person who brings his visitor along is Chris Kelvin. And all the others, you don't really see them.
Well, in the 72 Solaris, it's a similar kind. Oh, 71? Oh, what did I say? 72? Oh, it's 72. So in that one, there's a similar thing. Like, they have this conference, and you realize that, you know, Kelvin's sitting there with his wife, and they're all this happy couple, and the other two scientists, the other two male scientists, are looking at them going, fucker, you're having sex with your visitor, and we have to kill ours every day? It's like, yeah. fuck
it's
this!
Unfair, yeah.
Really unfair. So then they're like, okay, let's... And the whole thing is like, okay, we'll beam your brain down to the planet, and then we have this other thing which can destroy the planet, this, you know, this antimatter... No, what is it? Like, this X-ray beam or something. No, they did the X-ray bombardment, and it was because of the X-ray bombardments, that's when the visitors started turning up, and yeah. they have these other things. They're trying to like, in the end, they're like, okay, it's us all there. It's us or it, you know, it's, yeah. We're going to do this thing. And in the book, it's explained well. In the audio drama, it's explained well. In the movie, I think it's done really well. You know, that whole thing, like, but why my brain image, you know, and this whole thing, they're looking at him just with the expression in their eyes. It's like, oh yeah, because I'm the only one here who's still kind of sane.
Yes.
And this is the thing. This other guy's committed suicide. This other guy's probably, he's a drunkard. This other person's, you know, this obsessive thing. Okay, I'm one who's most balanced
here. But in the Soderbergh, you don't get all that.
No, all of that's gone. It's just like, and then Viola Davis playing Gordon, who is Sartorius, who just turns out and is okay of coming out. And just her character is just like gutted of all the stuff. She also has the worst techno babble ever. Like, and we were talking to this the other night to Alberto, a friend of ours, who is an astrophysicist. And I was like, have you seen Solaris? And he's like, yeah. And I was telling him about this. So Gordon, it's like, oh yes, I work for the company, and NASA was going to sell this space station to the company, whatever the company was, this energy company. So I was trained in physics and then came here to decide if this is a good bet or not. And you're like, And this was one of these things, it's like, how can you say I was trained in physicist? You should be saying I am a physicist, because she's obviously trying to play the part of a like a strong, intelligent, you know, genius level physicist, like astrophysicist or particle physicist. And later on, she's talking about, oh yes, and we have this thing here with this Higgs field, negative Higgs field reversing thing, and it's gonna, which is, I think they kind of messed up. And this is what I was saying before. Yeah. They kind of messed up there by saying bring in Higgs field is like going, oh yeah, quantum blah blah blah, handwavium, you know, it's that whole kind of thing. But now everybody knows what the Higgs, well not everyone, but like the Higgs field and Higgs boson is like world news event, like headline news events, like for a long time. We know how difficult it is to create like to get a significant amount, which is like, we don't, there's so little Higgs particles we've ever discovered. We can't even see them. We have to like, they decay from that into that, and from that into that, into that, into that. And then we find out, you know, sigma five. We're pretty sure.
For
you know,
some part of a
split
millisecond,
we know that
it was there.
And probably within this range, a very tight range, but in this range, you know, and that's what we got. And that's using a machine which cost like 10 billion euros or whatever it is.
2 kilometers.
It's more than that. It's like 16 kilometers across. And we know how difficult it is to make Higgs particles and Higgs fields. And in this book, it's like, oh yeah, we'll just reroute the thing. And it's like, yeah, like, it would have been better.
Movie.
Yeah, in the movie, it's like, you would have been better not talking about the techno babble and jargon and stuff like that, and just going directly for, we're going to do this. You know, we're going to do the, I mean, I don't even know how you would even do that. But when you're listening to it, you're just going, like, you're cringing. And this person who's obviously a genius and she can do this, she can set up this thing and do that. But she was trained in physics. Like, I was trained in physics and then I came here. It's like you as a classical singer. It's like, yes, I have been trained to sing. It's like, no, I am a singer. Of course, you obviously classically trained pianist or classically, you know, you always get that, oh, classically trained pianist, you know, oh, but that's like a higher level. But you don't say, I was classically trained like, as a pianist.
No. But the difference is that I am a musician and I am trained in classical singing.
Yes.
The classical singing is a part of music. Yeah. But I would never say I was trained in music.
Yes.
That's just bullshit.
So if you were like a biologist or something like that, and you've got your doctorate, you've got three things, and you've published all these papers, and you were nominated for, maybe didn't win, but you've been nominated for Nobel Prizes. And as a biologist, and then someone taught you about physics because you needed to know it for like a paper or one research project. You could say, I was trained in physics. But, you know, they didn't even say I was trained in astrophysics. I was trained in particle physics.
Exactly.
I was trained in
took the whole
biophysics.
Subject,
you know, sort of like this.
Physics.
Yes, I was trained in physics. Anyway, that's just a small line. But like I picked out some of these bad translations from the book, you can pick out a few of these lines and you just go, you put absolutely no effort into this script at all.
Yes.
You put no effort into this story. You gutted Solaris of all of the good stuff. You removed, and the spaceship, like Solaris Station, is perfectly clean. Everything's perfect. When she takes off her dress, she's just naked. They have sex right away, but it's a dream, but it isn't. You know, and all these things which make Solaris, like, beautiful, which makes Solaris not like, I don't want to say like Solaris or the station beautiful, but like make it a world which is interesting, make it a scene and this
different
stuff
from Earth and just a space station
and then,
somewhere.
And then Rhea in 2002 movie versus Harry in 72 version, the acting is just like she has to carry, she is the heart of the movie because she is Solaris,
yes.
You know, she represents one person going to Solaris and discovering himself.
Yeah.
She is Solaris.
In the 2002 movie, there's this one scene where
she drinks the nitrogen. Is that the? Is it?
No, this is where she says something about herself, and then suddenly,
I don't remember anything.
From the net, you don't see her, and then the camera points back to her, and suddenly her eyes are full with tears.
Oh, yes. There's so much crying in the movie,
and then it's just like it's no development. Everything is just, it goes from one scene to the next one. And all this development and all this long periods of something. Everything is missing. I mean, it's 99 minutes. What can you expect?
But yeah, exactly. Instead of spending 5 minutes having characters looking at each other and talking things over and deciding stuff and looking out the window and then looking back at each other and the lighting, or one of them standing up and then one of them sits down and the other one stays standing. All of these things. It's just like, okay, put tears in her eyes and make him angry. And it's like, rah, 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 rah. And then next scene, and you're like, that's it. That's what we get.
And then George Clooney turns around and then hugs her, and then he cries.
Yeah.
It's like,
and then she cries, and then he cries.
Whoa, whoa, whoa! That these emotions, they are very, very quick.
But one thing that comes off straight away when Rhea turns up in 1972 Tarkovsky Solaris, she's like, oh, what's going on? And you think, oh, she's going to be playing quirky pixie annoying girl. But she, like, over the course of half an hour, she gets, like, this strength which you didn't know was possible in this visitor. She builds up, and by the end of it, you look at her and you're like, holy fuck, I'm not messing with her. Of course, she's meant to be super strong, like she can break through a doorway, and if she hurts herself, she heals. You know, she does actually have these, like, superhuman, because she isn't human, you know. I mean, she is human. She's human at a molecular level and a cellular level, but at an atomic level. Oh yeah, that's another bit of jargon. Are they made of subatomic particles? Yes, they're made of subatomic particles. It's like everything is made of subatomic particles, because what are particles made of? Subatomic particles. You know, no, what are cells made of? Everything is made of, like, literally everything in the world is made up of subatomic particles. So it's like, what are they made of? Subatomic particles. It's like, yeah, weirdly, me too, and this space station, and that rocket, and that planet. Everything is made, well, actually, no, that's the thing. Solaris isn't made of subatomic particles, because when you go down past the electron scanning microscope, you get, and it's like, oh, the resolution, there's still more stuff down there, you know, that we can't see. Yeah. So the whole point is that they're not made of subatomic particles. They're actually made of, like, other weird... Solaris particles. you don't really know what they're made out of, some kind of, like, dark energy or dark matter. You know, anyway, it's difficult to say, like, antimatter bound with... Yeah. Whatever it could have been, don't say what... Again, I don't want to say that literally the entire universe is made of subatomic particles, because the whole point is that there's bits of it which might not be. Anyway, so...
So you can see by the rating.
No, don't go. We'll get to that in a second. We'll do ratings in a minute. Okay, but again, this movie. In the original movie, she has to break through a wall and shows that she can heal and that she's got superhuman strength.
Because
once you know what's that?
Like, it's like the second scene.
Yeah, in the book, he leaves and she breaks through the doorway out into the corridor. In the 72 movie, he goes into the shower and she breaks through into the shower, which is actually like a really, really kind of, because there she's trying to break into something rather than break out. Actually, you know, it's a different way, and I actually like that better about the movie than the book. You know, there's a few things that I like about these different things more than the book, but you need to know that first of all she heals. And you need to know that it's really difficult to kill her.
And it's difficult for her to just stay there by herself.
And also, but then when she goes out and she drinks the liquid oxygen or liquid nitrogen or whatever it is, I can't remember which it is in the different books and stuff, but in the 72 movie, she looks like, I am going to drink this because I want to commit suicide. And she is in massive amounts of pain. The camera lingers on her and she's not wearing very much, which is, you think, oh, is it meant to be sexy? But it isn't. You're meant to see the agony in her body. And you really understand, like, wow, look at the strength of this character, that she's going to commit suicide in this way. And that she's destroying everything about her body. She becomes an icicle, she becomes a popsicle, she becomes whatever it is like that. And then they bring her back and she slowly gets back and you see her, that healing process. And of course it's like 10 minutes of the movie for this scene. And then 2002 she's like, oh, she drank this liquid nitrogen, liquid oxygen.
In there, she drank oxygen.
Oh, okay.
Liquid oxygen. And then in the other one, she drank liquid nitrogen.
Was it? I can't remember which way around it was. Yes. But she has this little bit of blue makeup going down the side of her cheek. And otherwise she looks just beautiful. And stuff. And you're just like, wait a second.
And this... then she has a bit of that healing thing where she has
cramps. But all it is, yeah, but you could see that they were like, hey, watch this movie of this awesome Russian actress doing this like 30 years ago. Do that same kind of thing. But there was nothing. There was nothing to her character building up to that. So if she did it, she just looked like a, you know, like a skinny, good-looking woman writhing around. And then it was like, is that meant to be sexy or whatever? Like, it's like a, the opposite of a death scene. I'm not quite sure which way around it goes.
You
but
don't
we're watching
see that
it.
She's suffering. And she's in pain.
We were watching it, and we had both had the remote controls. We were sometimes just pausing it. I watching that scene, I just paused, and I was like, this is boring.
Yeah.
And in the 1972 movie, that was one of the most dynamic scenes where you, like, one of the best character moments, because Chris Kelvin is going, do I want to help this woman die or do I want to save her? And she is going, you know, all of these different characters go, all of these different things going on, and these other characters like the, like Sartorius and Snout come up and watch, and all this other kind of stuff going, yeah, what's he going to do? What's going to happen here? Where is he going to take her? Is he going to take her to the morgue or is he going to take her to the back to the room or to the lab or and all this kind of stuff? There's all this other stuff going on, and it's in a dirty corridor, and it's like she's kicking stuff and kicking him, and just like there's like sweat and blood and ice falling off her. And in 2002 Solaris, I was just watching it, just going, this is boring. Like, it was just one of those things that when you're watching it, you're just going, how can this scene in this other movie be like the highlight of the, or one of the highlights of the movie? And here I'm watching it, and I literally just don't give a shit what happens to anyone on the screen. I don't care about anyone.
It's just because the characters have no development, and you don't live through emotions with them. You just see them having troubles and conversations.
Yeah.
And you're not being attached to these characters at all, because it's not enough time. It's no time to spend with these people.
And then at the end of Solaris, 2002 Solaris, they had this twist, which I actually quite like the twist, except that it made the rest of the film leading up into that twist way, way more boring, and it made the characters not make any sense. The idea being that, I'm just going to spoil it, because fuck it, you're not going to watch this movie anyway. I recommend against it. The idea being that Snow, he goes, where are your visitors? He's like, my visitor doesn't turn up anymore. And the idea being that his visitor was himself, and now he has replaced himself. Like, he dreamt of himself, and his visitor was himself. And because when George Clooney turns up, it's like, whose is this blood? And he's like, oh yeah, that blood in this guy. And you think, oh, maybe he's just stoned, because like in the book he's always drunk, or he's drinking a lot, and in the movie, the other movie, he's drunk a lot. And it turns out that he's actually been replaced by himself. But the whole point of the book or on these other ones is that your character, like the... In the English via French translation, it's the negress, which I think is just terrible. Like, oh, his, you know, Gilberian's visitor was a negress. And in the other translation, it was a large black woman, you know, that kind of stuff.
But she, also at the same time, a monstrous
negress. And you're like, okay, whatever. And in the audio drama, it's like, oh yeah, he said about this time in Africa. You know, in the book, it doesn't say that, but that's one of the additions to the audio drama that I like. Is like going, oh yeah, because Gilberian knew Kelvin from long before, didn't he? It's like, oh, it probably because he hinted about something in Africa, and you realize, oh, the monstrous black woman is probably like an affair that he had with his housemaid, and then she had a kid, and then he killed her because he couldn't let his wife find out. You know, you're kind of constructing these monstrous circumstances in his backstory, and then that, you know, this weird thing, and it's, oh, but it was in Africa, so it's just this. You know, it, like in him, it, you know, in this character, it's just like, oh, well, she was a black woman. That's whatever. Anyway, so what was I saying here? Oh, yeah. So the point is that when he died, she would go and lay with him in the morgue. Like, she would just go and lay on top of his dead body.
Yes.
And then you're going, well, if that's the case, and it was just another reason why Solaris 2002 movie fell apart, where you're going, well, he should have just spent all his time hanging out in the morgue with his dead. Yeah. Alpha, and if he was the copy,
yes,
anyway,
that doesn't, yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
So yes, terrible acting, gutting the story, and which is in the, then you have a look here, Solaris 1972, this is on IMDb, 8.0. that's really high. That's a really high Metascore what is this, Metacritic, an 8, Metascore, you know, it's like these Rotten Tomato scores. It's going to be high. The reason is, I think, is because Solaris, if you're going to watch Solaris 1972, you've got to have to want to watch it. You know, you're a movie fan and you're like, okay, was this, you know, this came out about the same time as, oh, a second, so 2001, when did 2000, oh, internet's not working. Oh, no, it's because if you just type in a number, it thinks it's like an IP address. So 2001 A Space Odyssey. Oh, that was 68, was it? Yeah, so that was 68. So you see, if you see 2001, which I actually watched on a flight a while ago, and then you see Tarkovsky's, you know, Solaris, you're like, okay, this was the science fiction movie making of the time. They're very much of the same. They've got like similar level of the special effects in 2001 are much better, but you know, it's got that same kind of level. These long drawn out scenes. It's like, and now we're gonna look at this person looking at something for 5 minutes. You know, they both got that same a similar kind of thing. And now we're gonna have somebody flying across this and going, changing consciousness, and we're going to represent that by looking at a picture or looking at this, and he's going to walk around a room for a long time and see, you know, you can see that kind of stuff. I thought 2001 was a 70s, like 1970 or something. It was 68, so around about the same kind of time. So anyway, yes, a score of 6.1 for Solaris 2002 and 8 for Solaris 1972. If you're going to watch one of these movies, watch it. But when you get to the scene of him driving through Tokyo, press fast forward. And when he starts looking at a painting, you could probably fast forward then as well. But those are the only two times when I was watching going, I'm a little bit bored now. But the rest of it, I think, is a remarkable movie. If you're going to read a translation, like I said before, read the direct to your language translation. Don't read the English version. Listen to the audio version. And I might as well just say, if you want to listen to it for free, if you're not already a member of Audible, you can download the Audible version for free and listen to it if you go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP. And you can sign up for a free 14-day trial or 30-day trial. I actually changed the offers. I'm not quite sure what the offer is. But if you don't want that one, you can actually get like 100,000 other books. But I really do recommend this. This is the only place you can get this is by going to Audible. You get a really good deal, and the deal is free if you sign up for a trial. And if you want to continue on, that's great. But just you signing up even for the free trial really does help out the Science Fiction Book Review podcast, and it helps pay for my Audible books and my reading and Juliana's books and stuff and things like that. So do you think we got into in-depth? We didn't really get that in-depth about the story so much. I mean, there's more stuff that you want to talk about.
If we were to talk about it, there's much more to say. But I think we did quite a good overview about all the things we did.
Yeah.
What I wanted to say was, when I started reading Solaris and I went through it and I thought, well, it's not really my kind of book. It's very philosophical and it's very long passages of him staring out of windows and stuff. And then we watched the Tarkovsky movie and I thought, well, this Tarkovsky movie is very cineastic and I don't really like it.
A bit too philosophical. Yeah, There's lots of him walking out of windows.
Yeah. And then we watched the Solaris 2002 movie, and now looking backwards again, I think, I understand why that movie is like that, and I understand what he wanted to say in the book, because when you speed that up, it doesn't work anymore. And if you leave out the philosophical readings about Solaris and all that stuff, it loses so much of his depth. And so looking backwards now, I actually enjoy it now.
There's a lot of these books where you read it and you're like, that wasn't much, and then it just doesn't leave your brain for a long time, and you realize that you just spent a week thinking about this book, and you're like, I didn't even really enjoy reading it. Like there's a book called Eiffelheim. Let me see if I can buy it. Was it by Michael Flynn? Is it Flynn? Yeah, Michael Flynn. Eiffelheim. Look at this score, 2. I gave it a 2. Because when I was reading it, I literally just stopped reading at one point because it annoyed me so much. Yes. And then I picked it back up and was reading more. And then when I was doing the review, I was like, oh, and I really like this bit, and I really like this bit, and this bit was really good, and this was great. Yeah. And the more of the bad stuff about it I forget, the more I enjoy the book. So every time that I look back and go, no, that's surely like a 3.5-star book, you know, surely it is. But then you actually go back and you read these opening, like this opening, like frame story, the bit, because part of it's set in medieval Germany, which I really love that part, and part of it's set in the modern day, and all the stuff set in the modern day spoils the other part, and all the stuff in the old part spoils the modern day stuff, and the modern day stuff is just really shit, and the characters, because he wrote a short story set in the modern day, and then he was like, oh, let me write what they discovered about the Dark Ages, you know, and he wrote that, and that as a novel would be awesome,
but he combined
but he combined the two, and it's just like, oh, it's just terrible. Yeah. And like every time I remember just how shit that short story was when set aside the novel, the medieval science fiction novel, you know, it's like aliens arrive in medieval Germany during the Black Plague. It's like, what can go wrong? That's going to be awesome. And there's loads of awesome stuff. But then you just go, oh, there's so much shit. But now when I think back again, I just remember the awesome aliens landing in medieval Germany.
But I think
part.
If you have a book, but you don't really enjoy it, and then you get something in you, like you get you get access to something that is actually worse.
Yeah.
You then suddenly understand more about the book, and you understand why something is like it, like it is.
Yeah.
And
you understand why they had to find out about the science. They spent a long time finding out about the science of Solaris.
Yes, but it's like looking back, it is interesting to see that they spend loads of time like exploring that and doing research and different ideas. And
yeah, I can't actually remember what I talked about in my previous review of this. I think I went into like the idea about like the basis of the science. I should have really should have listened to that, you know. I should have listened to my previous podcast, so I wasn't sure what I was repeating or what I covered or what I missed, because so often I'll do a review and I was like, oh, there was a really important point that I was going to bring up, and I just totally forgot about it, and then I can't bring it up on the next podcast because that's a different book. But if it's a series, I could maybe bring it up and say, oh, and I forgot to mention this about the previous book in the series. But here it's just like we've done this extra podcast about it, and I don't even know. But you know what? Last time it says here on the if you go to episode lists, sfbrp.com, and click on episode list, you can see the ratings of all this book. I gave it 4 stars last time I listened, when I listened to the audiobook. Yeah. I'm going to bump that up to 4.5 stars. I think it's actually a lot better now that I've seen the movies. And the same with you with the Triffids and watching 28 Days Later. You read the book and you go, oh, that's actually a lot better movie now that I've seen the book. And then also the movie kind of reflects on what you liked and didn't like about the book. You know, again, it's the same kind of thing that we had with the Triffids, I think, which we did like 5 or 6 episodes ago.
And also because it was the first time I had contact with Solaris, I knew about it, but I never read it in my youth or something. It was the first time I've read it. And and then we did the movie marathon behind it. And really, it makes a big difference to see a story through somebody else's eyes, kind of.
Yeah, it's like, what did they think was the important part?
Exactly.
And you realize what the important part is. It's because it's this line which is repeated in most of the things, you know, like in the audiobook and in the Tarkovsky movie. And it's the whole like, man has gone out to explore other worlds without first having explored his own labyrinth of dark passages and secret chambers. You know, that kind of thing. Like, waiting unconsciously for a revelation to explain the destiny of man. I can't remember what these lines are from, but these, you know, these are the whole idea. We wanted to conquer the cosmos. No, we didn't want to conquer the cosmos. We simply wanted to expand the boundaries of Earth out. Yeah. You know, we're not exploring elsewhere. We're not learning about the alien. And maybe that's what I talked about. Maybe that's what I talked about in my previous review, is like the unknowability of the non-human.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter how inhuman you make any alien, it's always like I'm talking meta wise like now in science fiction, no matter how alien you make an alien, no matter how non-human you make a non-human character, when humans look at it, they see themselves. Yes. And this is what this science fiction
about.
Yeah, of course, it's always about this.
Learn about themselves and about them, like about their own behavior. That makes it so that makes this book so good, because it's everything is about just themselves.
Yes, but there's this great bit in the book. They left out of the adaptations because it doesn't really work, where he's going, oh, am I real? Like, is this happening in my brain? There's a whole kind of like solipsism argument going on. It's like, well, how can I prove to myself that what I am seeing is true? Okay, I'll plot this star. Is it plotting the stars? I can't remember how he does it in this thing.
And then he does the mathematics.
No, does he do that in the movie, the Tarkovsky movie? It's just in the book.
It's just in the book where
he goes,
the mathematics.
Right, I'm gonna. Oh, no, I understand, because I was thinking, but I thought he did it in two different ways, actually, but it was another one of the characters, like Snout, said, oh, yeah, I did this, and I looked at this thing with this microscope. You know, they both did the test. He's like, I'm gonna plot the orbit of this station with the radio, but I won't look at the answer, and then I'll work out the answer myself and then compare the two. And you're reading that, and I'm thinking, that doesn't really solve it. You're just taking a step back. You're going, well, how do you know what the computer's giving you, or when you unfold that paper? You know, so there's one of those weird things in the whole, like, is this actually happening in my brain, or is it real? I quite like that little diversion of Lem into that little question and then back out of it and going, and the character himself is like, oh yes, I'm satisfied, and we as the readers are going, what's that line, it sounded clumsy even to my ears, you know. And you're reading that going, really, Kelvin, are you really sure? And Kelvin's like, no, I'm just sticking with that, you know. And you well, yeah, we've got to draw the line somewhere, otherwise we're just gonna keep going further and further into our
what
own
is life.
Yes, it's like, yeah. So anyway, but what I really like about this book is that other science fiction stories, they tell a story and they bring in ideas of, like, what is it to be alien, what is it to be human, but that is the story of this one. It's literally like, here's some humans, they're aliens. Here's some aliens, they're humans. Here's this character, it's not about him. Here's this character, here's a massive planet. Here's chapters and chapters full of science. You want science fiction? Here's a rocket. You want science fiction? Here's a space station. You want science fiction? Here's, like, this person going exploring, and there's this person flies into this thing, and here's a mimoid, and here's an asynchronoid, or whatever they call them, this kind of thing. And you get to the end, and you, like, turn that last page, and you're like, shit, it's about man and the darkness within man. And they turn the red flag and it's like, darkness, all is dark. And it's like, oh, we've done a Heart of Darkness here. But it's not set in the Congo or in Vietnam, like, you know, all this other kind of stuff. It's like, like Apocalypse Now. It's like, okay, well, he goes. But the weird thing is that in the book, the last thing that he does is he goes down and lands on Solaris. And the way that I read that is him pretty much going, it's a bit boring. Well, it's not really boring, but he lands there and he goes, oh, well, I've done it now. I've landed on Solaris, and looks around and goes, well, you know, humans are more interesting than even the most fascinating thing that they've been studying for 120 years, or has been discovered 120 years, this alien form which can control the orbit of planets and control the stars, or is it the retrograde orbit, you know, all this different kind of stuff, and it can project things, and it's got unlimited power and infinite non-Euclidean depths to this ocean. It can project humans, it can read your brains and all that kind of stuff. And by the end of it, he goes, yeah, like, the human mind and the human brain is like that to anyone. Even to the person whose brain it is, their brain is like that to them. So if we're going to look at Solaris in a very much a reductive kind of way, but like you say, it's interesting to see these other storytellers and what they get out of it. Like, Tarkovsky looks at it and he sees that same kind of thing, like, holy shit, man's brain and fucked up darkness. Yeah. The audio drama, BBC audio drama, is like, holy shit, fucked up darkness. But, you know, there's a nice little thing with Rhea coming along. Oh shit, well, okay, well, that's probably not going to end well either. Yeah. And then Soderbergh looks at it and goes, love story, la 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 la, I love you, I love too. Oh yeah, that was the thing. It's sort of like, I love you, but I'm not Rhea. And in the whole point is like, I love you, but I'm not real Rhea. And it's like, yes, but I don't love real Rhea anymore. I love you. I love you version of, I don't, it's not that you're a version of Rhea and I love you because you, I love Rhea and you're a copy of her. I love you because you. Yeah. Like, I love you because of your humanity, even though you're alien visitor from outer space. Anyway, so maybe we're just rambling now. We could, like I say, oh, we won't talk too much about the ideas and stuff. We'll just talk about the movies, and we just spent another 10 minutes just talking about that. Anyway, yeah, we've gone on long enough. We've gone two English translations. We've one via French. We've done one Polish to German translation. We've done a Polish to Russian movie, and then with English subtitles back again. And then the English movie is obviously English to French, Polish to French to English to movie. And then the audiobook is English to French to English. English to audiobook. Audio drama. Sorry, I'm getting mixed up. So anyway, we've gone a lot of different ways. I think we've explored Solaris enough. Probably this will be our last episode on Solaris.
Yeah.
Unless in another 5 years, I have another girlfriend and we do an episode. Ow! I do another episode about Solaris. Or maybe a new movie will be made. Or maybe some other thing. We'll talk about Solaris in the future. So
I'm done now with Solaris.
Yes, yeah, so that's what I say when I get a new girlfriend. I will... Look, if you just punch me or laugh, people can't hear it. You've got to... So the next book that I'm going to review is actually an ebook that I got called... Let me click here on goodreads.com. It's called Off to Be the Wizard by Scott Mayo, who is a web comic? Yeah, I guess web comic artist, writer and stuff like that. So I'm reading that as an ebook that he published, self-published on the Kindle store and things like that. So I'm looking forward to that. Also, I have already finished the audiobook of Rendezvous with Rama by Arthur C. Clarke. I don't think I've done an Arthur C. Clarke book yet on the podcast, mainly because I read all of his good science fiction before starting this podcast. So let me just look here. Have I done sorted by author? Yeah. Anyway, tell me what it's called in German.
It's called Rendezvous mit 31439.
Because Rama in Germany is a
margarine brand.
Yeah, it's a brand of margarine. So it's like Rendezvous with Flora, or Rendezvous with I Can't Believe It's Not Butter, or Rendezvous with what is it, the maid? What's the maid? Milk? No, maid. Something maid? Milk maid?
Milk maid.
No, what is it?
I don't know.
Maid margarine. Something made, table made, table dairy made, something made,
dairy.
No, I don't know.
Anyway, so in the German book version, it's called Rendezvous with 31439.
Because that's what its original name is, isn't it? It's called that to begin with, and they said, but we had to give it a good name, so we called it Rama.
That's just yeah.
Anyway, so
we will talk about that.
I read that and thoroughly enjoyed it. We will talk about that, and also at the beginning of this book, at the beginning of that review, we will also talk about other Arthur C. Clarke, some of his novels and some of his collaborations with other authors. Because after Rendezvous with Rama, there was Rama Returns and Rama Revealed and Gardens of Rama. Rama 2, Rama Revealed and Gardens. Anyway, there's others, but he didn't write them by himself. There was someone else wrote them. So we'll talk about a little bit about that as well. So that's coming up in the future. Otherwise, go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP if you want to listen to Solaris, the audiobook, for free. That's the best way to do that there. Sign up for an Audible account, trial plan thing. You can go to sfbrp.com and click on episode lists and see every episode that we've done so far, even the ones that are falling off of the end of the RSS feed and have fallen out of iTunes because now we've done too many episodes. You can find them there. Check it out. Look at this. There's 190 episodes in the feed now, it says here. Actually, there's more than that in the feed because there's when I'm guest on other episodes and stuff like that. But 5.8 days worth of audio, 3.81 gigabytes of audio. So if you want to listen to every single episode of the SFBRP, you're going 5.8 days there. You can find all of those there on the SFBRP. Otherwise, on Twitter, I'm Luke Burridge. And you can also check out Juliana. She is on Goodreads as well. And you can be my friend on Goodreads. She's on Twitter. And you also got a website. So if you want to hear Juliana sing or buy her CD, you can go to, is it JK Soprano? Is that right?
It's not yet there.
It doesn't redirect. You got that, didn't you?
Yeah, but I didn't do it because of my English.
Oh, you're going to. Oh, that's going to be the English website.
Yeah,
is it?
You can go to duomusici.
Yeah, and you can. Anyway, I'll put some links on the blog there on the sfbrp.com. Anyway, that's it. Yeah, goodreads.com. Go there and you can discuss stuff with other listeners on the Goodreads SFBRP listener group, or just comment directly on the reviews that I put up here. Again, there's links right there in the show notes and on the episodes list page, so you can chat with other SFBRP listeners over there.
And if you enjoy our collaboration talks about books, just tell us.
Yeah, email luke@juggler.net. That's the best way to get in hold, get a hold of me.
Maybe you have an idea of something we should discuss together.
But I really enjoy doing, like, because people say, oh, why don't you review this science fiction movie that comes out, or this science fiction movie, or this fantasy thing that comes out? And I'm just like, I'm not really, like, I enjoy talking about science fiction movies, but I wouldn't be able to go into them in the same way that I do with these books. But I really enjoy these discussions where we're like, okay, there's the Hobbit book and the Hobbit movie, and there's the, you know, and there's the Solaris book, and there's the, you know, and the movie and the other movie and the audio, and with the Triffids and the movie and the other movie, or the 28 Days Later movie, and we can go into these different.
We can do one when the Ender's Game movie comes out, because read Ender's Game as well.
I'll reread Ender's Game, no problem at all. I've read it a few times in the past.
Maybe I'm looking forward to see how they do the movie with that one.
Did you know Ender's Game was the first ever non-episode of SFBRP I ever recorded?
No,
because there was a podcast series that I listened to called Movies You Should See, and they discuss movies, and they're like, well, we're setting up a new podcast called Books You Should Read, but it's not going to be us. You send in your review, like do an audio review of a book and send it in. And so at the time, I was actually already like doing some test recordings of like the SFBRP. I was like, well, how long is the episode going to be? Is it going to be like 5 minutes, or is it going to be 10 minutes? It turns out now we're doing an hour and a half on this one, but all these different things. And so they said, well, send in your review. And I was like, well, I just read Ender's Game not too long ago. I'll just do a review of that and send it in. So I sent it in, and they liked my recorded episode so much of all the initial ones that they used that as episode number one of Books You Should Read.
That's
and I
good.
Was like, oh, well, if they like that and they think it's a good episode, I will do my own podcast. So there is actually an Ender's Game episode that I posted here on the book. Actually, I could just look for it by going at that. Ender's Game, yeah, episode 58. But all I did actually was just take that previous episode. I think all I did was take the previous episode and post it again in the feed. I can't remember. Or maybe I didn't. Maybe I did a whole new review of it. I can't remember. Anyway, so we might do Ender's Game when the movie comes out.
Yes.
Is that a good one?
That's a good one.
I'll reread it or listen to it as an audiobook.
Yes.
And you can read Ender's Shadow. Oh no, what's the other one where they tell the story? They tell the story from the other point of view. Yeah, I think you might like that actually, because you know there's the little kid in it, the little weedy one. I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
Anyway, they retell that whole story from his point of view.
Ah, okay.
So
good idea.
It's not a very good book.
No.
Well, actually, it's an interesting book because it's one of those interesting things where you go, well, what would that same story look like from this other character's point of view when you already know the twist at the end, like,
yeah,
and you don't need to worry about the twist at the end? What would it be like from that character? So there is actually some good material in there and some good character stuff, but it does kind of like negate a lot of the some of the plot points. It's like, oh, and the battle room. It's like, well, how does the battle room not have any, you know, when they go in there and they're flying around and there's no gravity, and it's like, when you're reading the book in Ender's Game, you don't really think about that, except at one point you're like, wait a second, just book it, it still does that, would that work? And then in the other book, this, where I think it's Ender's Shadow, I can't remember, when they talk about it this other way, they're like, oh, and actually they have this other technology which they use here and use there, and you're like, oh, it kind of takes it, like, it doesn't focus so much on the story and character anymore.
Let's talk about it when we talk about it.
Yeah, we've gone on long enough. Oh, an hour and 35. Anyway, this has been a good chat. We would have done this earlier, it's just we've been really busy. We had a show last night in our apartment, which was pretty cool. About 30 people turned up to watch us do some music and juggling. And I just wanted to mention, if you don't have a dishwasher, well, I wouldn't say get a dishwasher. Clearing it, this is the first big party that we've had where we've had a dishwasher in the house to clear up afterwards with, and it's so awesome. Anyway.
Do you have to say whose idea it was?
The dishwasher. Yeah, I bought you a dishwasher for your birthday. There you go. Juliana never washed up. I did all of the washing.
That is not true.
Until I would go away on a cruise and then I'd come back. And then when I arrived back home, it was so stressful for Juliana to have actually done a week's worth of like one person living alone in a house washing up, that we spent like €1,000 buying a dishwasher and refitting into the kitchen and stuff like that, just because Juliana was slightly stressed out about doing washing up, which I would have done anyway when I got home. But it is definitely worth having a dishwasher. It's been great. Anyway, that's it for now. Thanks a lot for listening. Say goodbye, Juliana.
Goodbye.
And I'll catch you next time.